Hi, I'm Steve Goldstein, and this is the Friday Newscap podcast. Each week, we review the biggest stories with experts, reporters, and commentators to put the news in perspective. Here's this week's episode.
We've got a lot of that support that was generated during the Red for Ed movement. We've got a lot of teachers and educators and, you know, community members who are ready to do some work and get some funding for schools. And so we're in the process of getting out there. We just released some poll numbers yesterday that show that 2/3 of Arizona voters support the initiative. So right now we're just collecting signatures.
Getting voters, eligible U.S. citizen voters, the right to vote is more important than sort of the bureaucratic paperwork that was apparently interpreted into the law by some folks. So I'm excited about the outcome here.
Free trade allows the most efficient allocation of labor and capital. Protectionism, on the other hand, stifles innovation and reduces productivity.
And with us to talk about whether Arizonans will raise the income tax on some to pay for increased education funding, along with Jeff Flake against President Trump, and an interesting trial involving the Corporation Commission, our former business executive and former congressional candidate Christine Jones, and former legislative leader and all-around Renaissance man Chris Hurstum. Welcome to you both. Thanks for being here.
Good morning.
Christine, let's start
I've never been called a Renaissance man.
I don't believe that for a second. Christine, let's start off with the Invest in Ed polling such as it is. We can sort of move beyond that. But based on the poll they released, 2/3 of Arizonans or so would be willing to vote to increase the income tax to pay for more K-12 funding. But it's a very limited number of people who would be hit by this. What do you make of those numbers, and do you buy it?
Well, I'll tell you what. Every time I'm out in public, the signature gatherers are ubiquitous, whether it's at the post office or at a convention center. They are everywhere, so I will be stunned if they don't get on the ballot. The numbers of people who support this don't surprise me entirely, when only 1% or a little bit less than 1% of the population will be impacted. Also, if you're a teacher and you make $35,000 a year, to say that households who make $500,000 will be affected, that's like a gazillion dollars to somebody who's basically making minimum wage. So I'm not surprised at all that 80% or so of the population are supporting it. So without stealing Chris's thunder, if it makes the ballot, it probably passes, unfortunately.
Yeah. Chris, you're an enthusiastic supporter, obviously, of the Red for Ed.
I am. And I don't even think the really potent arguments in favor of it have been made yet, because it's sort of, you know, we're at that point where they're just trying to get on the ballot. Once a campaign starts, I think what folks will be reminded is we're only talking, as Christine said, about the upper 1%. And those folks, the average 1%er, in their federal tax cut that they just got, that's going to be in place now for a long time, they average $48,000 in cuts, the 1%er in Arizona. This increase is $30,000 increase. So they're still going to net $18,000 when you look at the federal and the state. So I think they'll more than be able to afford it. But there's one other statistic in this poll that doesn't get much publicity that I think is fascinating. And it will tie into the governor's race, et cetera. And that is that 70% of the folks that they polled said that the Ducey Republican budget that just passed was not enough and that more money needed to be invested in K-12. That attitude will have ramifications throughout the 2018 elections, not only in this initiative battle, but also in politics.
Yeah, so I want to ask more about that. So we were talking before, Steve and I, that wondering what the public perception of this really is. Like, after all was said and done, it was a little murky, like who won, who lost, was there enough money put into education? The teachers still weren't happy, but there was a deal. Where do you think that lies?
Well, I will say from my perspective, the win was good. The 20% by 2020 was good, but it was only a start. And the Prop 123 money seems like it didn't really do what they said it was going to do. And so this notion of having another $690 million per year to education offends nobody, including the top 1%. Now, the way to get there may not be as satisfying to the people who are paying for it, but look, if you have a net gain on your income tax, that's a pretty compelling argument that these people could make. I think the fact that the teachers, the assistants, the administrators, the parents are still out in force weeks after the budget was passed saying, thank you, legislators, and yet we still need to fix our roofs and we still need to buy new textbooks and we still need to get desks and we still need computers suggests that this is the real deal, that that budget was, in fact, not enough.
Mm-hmm. Christine, you said unfortunate before in a previous answer about the fact that this could pass or would pass. Do you think there's a way to get more money to the schools, which I think everyone agrees on, maybe not 100%, but almost everyone agrees on that. And many people believe that the extra money would do something, not that the money's going to solve things. But are we in a position where the only way to get the money, regardless of what Governor Ducey had with Proposition 123, do you have to raise taxes in some way, whether it's sales, whether it's income?
Well, you probably have to have additional revenue. Whether that means to raise taxes is unclear. Whether you can pay for that through spending cuts is doubtful because we've done a lot of cutting over the last decade. I say unfortunately because I'm a conservative and I don't think the income tax is the way to tax because it only taxes a very small slice of the population, particularly in a state that relies significantly on tourism for taxation. A transaction tax, if you must have a tax, would be my strong preference because then you actually tax transient people, people who are passing through, and it becomes a more ubiquitous level playing field. I understand that some people think it disproportionately disadvantages people who have low incomes, and I don't deny that.
Yeah, I where we disagree here is that I think the income tax is the way to go because it is truly the progressive tax. Those that make more money can afford to pay more taxes. The sales tax that we have relied on at the state and local level in a ridiculous way, we now have one of the highest sales tax statewide, local and state taxes than any other state because it was easy to sell from a political standpoint. Republicans would embrace it because they tend to represent the more wealthy, upper middle income folks that benefit by increased reliance on a sales tax. Sales tax is horribly regressive. Middle income, low middle income, and low income pay a higher percentage of their personal income when they are dinged at the sales tax. And when you compare that to this Invest in Ed Act that's only going to hit the one percenters and that they're actually going to net revenue anyway because they got a huge reduction at the federal level, to me it just can be sold in many different ways.
But don't you think there's going to be enough of an effort to try to quash this by special interests? Like, what do you think that message will look like? And do you think that the Invest in Ed people have enough money to fight back in you know, on the airwaves, essentially?
That's a great question. I actually tried to find the answer to that in anticipation of your question. And I couldn't get a good answer for how well-funded will it be. And yet, if you're collecting hundreds of thousands of signatures with volunteer help, you may not need to spend a whole lot of money because it is such an easy yes to get when you say, don't you think we should support schools? Mm-hmm. Hardly anybody says no to that.
I want to watch Doug Ducey as he's running for re-election and Mark Brnovich as he's running for re-election and Michelle Reagan as she tries to run for re-election. I want to watch they and their party defend the millionaires in the state of Arizona who are still going to have a net reduction in their taxes when you look at feds and state. I want to see them do that because I think politically that really will hurt them.
Well, how much money, though, is going to come from opposition on this one? If, in fact, it gets on the ballot, we have seen big money put into things that, you know, really aren't going to impact people quite as much as this could.
Sure. A lot of wealthy CEOs and a lot of dues-paying wealthy people through the Arizona Chamber.
But are these folks who
would
support—
They will spend money to try to make it look like it's an evil tax increase by some teachers' union. I don't think the folks are going to buy that for the exact reasons that Christine said. This is a grassroots, parents- and teachers-oriented initiative that I think will win the day.
Okay, but are these CEOs you're talking about folks who would, in fact, support additional education funding, they're just not that big on being taxed themselves for this.
Oh, they always say that. You know, they always talk a good game through the GPL and through, you know, the chambers that, yes, we believe in investing more in education. And then they have their lobbyists down at the state capitol who are scrounging around to reduce taxes. And Doug Ducey and the legislature has reduced taxes every single year, you know, for all through the recession, et cetera. And so they never come up with new money. This is the folks taking it into their own hands, enacting their own upper 1% tax that will be a dedicated funding source that the politicians won't be able to touch.
Just one last point on that, and maybe slightly outside of the scope of this discussion. There are going to be a number of ballot initiatives on the ballot in the general election in November, and how much money gets spent on each one may depend on which ones actually appear. So that may be something we can discuss as the months goes on. There really is a finite bucket of money to spend, and it's going to have to be allocated to some of these other initiatives probably as well.
Yeah. One thing I always wonder when this comes up, we talked about this with Prop 1232, is this just the way we fund education in this state? Like, is it going to be through a citizens initiative or through a local bond
yes,
or something like that,
it
right?
It will, because the politicians, at least the Republican-controlled state capitol right now, will not do it on their own.
Yeah.
Doug Ducey would not have done his increase in salaries without 50,000 parents and teachers marching. I mean, he was only throwing out a 1% increase. So, yes, it's going to take grassroots. It's going to take the people voting, which we have in this state. The people can make laws, and that's what's going to have to happen, in my opinion, to have dedicated funding sources for the future. Let me just remind you, this is a little depressing. Even if this passes, the $690 million, in addition to what the Ducey Republican budget, when you combine those two, it still raises just over $1 billion, and that's the $1 billion that was cut from K through 12 during the recession. It's actually not new money beyond what they had from the recession when it began a decade ago.
All right, that's Chris Hurst. I'm also here is Christine Jones. I'm Steve Goldstein with Lauren Gilger. We're in the midst of the Friday newscap, which continues right after this. Good morning. It's the Friday newscap here on the show on 91.5 KJZZ in Phoenix with Lauren Gilger. I'm Steve Goldstein. We're joined today by former business executive and former congressional candidate Christine Jones and former legislative leader Chris Hurstum. Christine, I know you're going to get a chance to jump in on this in a moment, but Chris has been champing at the bit to talk about this Corporation Commission-related trial and some of the ins and outs of this. So let's go over some of the basics of this, Chris. We have a former corporation commissioner who allegedly was involved in funneling money on behalf of a well-known developer in the East Valley. What are the most intriguing parts of this trial for you so far?
Well, I personally don't give a rat's how it turns out, okay? It's like peanuts. Okay. You know, it's $30,000, a sweetheart land deal. There's two things that I've taken away already from this trial before the defense has ever put on their show yet. Number one, we've already seen just through email evidence, the unbelievable coziness between a sitting corporation commission chairman and a utility, a water company that they regulate. I mean, Gary Pierce was, through emails, you can see this between the husband and wife at the time, Gary Pierce was working for Johnson Utilities, doing things for them, and he's a sitting corporation commission chairman, and he has his wife doing things. I mean, that may not be illegal, but it stinks, and it shows the corruption that is there at the Corporation Commission. Mm-hmm. But here's the juicy part. The juicy part appeared before the trial, really before they brought the jury into the room, and that was the prosecutors announcing to the world that they had offered a plea bargain to every one of the defendants if they would cooperate in the bigger ongoing criminal investigation that they acknowledge was still going on. So and they turned the plea bargain down so far, mm-hmm. okay, so far. But all you have to do is play the guessing game, and you don't have to guess. Who could Jim Norton, the lobbyist, and Gary Pierce, the former Corporation Commission chairman, who could they have turned on? What did they have in common that the prosecutors are really looking at, the big fish in the sea? And you come up very easily with the answer, APS. Mm-hmm. And perhaps the Arizona Chamber that Norton lobbied for. He lobbied for APS. So they're the ones that are still in the sights of the criminal prosecutors, and to me that's far more fascinating than this trial.
Yeah. Christine, one thing that came to mind for me, I know it's not apples to apples, but we think about how lawmakers run for these jobs for $24,000 a year. We're talking about this kind of money that Chris mentioned, really not that much. So it's obviously about something different than that. But what are your general thoughts on this?
Well, the corporation commissioners do make a nickel or a dime more than that, but nevertheless, it's mm-hmm. not big money. Mm-hmm. The thing that really strikes me about this is how much power Jim Norton had, both at the Corporation Commission and at the state capitol. I have heard from members who asked for anonymity who've said they're scared of him and he threatens them. And if you don't vote the way that I want you to or the way the governor wants you to, we will take you out, sort of those sorts of things. This is a remarkable admission on the part of a member of our legislature. The Corporation Commission corruption, which seems to go pretty deep, at least with respect to one member, just makes me sad. It makes me sad for a woman like Kelly Norton, who is on the verge of tears as she testifies, and who kept very excruciatingly detailed records because she knew what she was doing was wrong, and she was basically forced into it by her bully of a husband. That, to me, is what is wrong with politics. It's why I ran for office. It's why APS attacked me when I ran for office, and it's why whatever happens there is only the beginning of opening the kimono and getting it cleaned out. And I don't have any ill will against any of these people as individuals, but I do have a strong dislike for public official misconduct, and I have zero tolerance, and I think anywhere it exists, from the lowest to the highest level, should be cleaned out, and we have to get rid of it.
Does this surprise you, though, in any way? I mean, this, like you said, Chris, is sort of a small potatoes, like, little hint at what might be happening on a larger scale. We had Susan Bittersmith happen. The Corporation Commission has been dogged by these things. Do you think it's much bigger?
Oh, it's much, much bigger. The thing that I am most disappointed in is the lack of investigative reporting over the last, since 2013 or so. And I know there's been tremendous cutbacks in journalism forces and so forth. But the lack of investigative reporting, because, you know, there's been talk constantly about, well, people at APS are having their laptops seized by the feds and things are being looked at. And you keep hearing all that scuttlebutt. Well, you know, it's rumors, but the point is, where's the media? Why aren't they covering this? And it's only now they stumbled upon the Johnson Utilities case, the smaller case, while they were doing this larger ongoing investigation. And obviously the prosecutors hope that Norton and that Pierce will turn and they can go after the bigger fish in the sea. But I think the lack of real zeroing in by the media on what really is going on, APS has got an enormous amount of clout in this community. And it's the most corruptive influence I've seen in my career, 35-year career at the state capitol, the last 4 or 5 years. And not to have the media sinking their teeth into this and lifting the rock and covering it is the most disappointing media thing that I've experienced as an Arizona citizen.
Well, Christine, you mentioned the ads that went after you when you were running for office. And we also see a lot of APS ads that are very, very positive. You know, we're just like you. It does make it interesting when Chris says this, to think that there is this power base there. So let me just ask you the question about corruption. Do we find people who get into office, too many of them who get in for other opportunities? Or are we finding that the system is so broken that we talk about in Washington? Could it be similar here and in every other state house across the country?
I really think most people go to office for right reasons. I think they're good-hearted, community-minded, service-oriented people. And only when they've been there for some amount of time does their network of relationships get so tightly wound that they find themselves stuck and having to bow down to the greater forces, whether they're good or evil. Mm. But on the broader corruption question, I think we have to say, let's not vilify a for-profit entity who is trying to satisfy its shareholders. My commercial focus would say that. But if I'm a shareholder and or a taxpayer and or a ratepayer, I might want to know what my public utility is spending its money on and who it's advocating for and what are the things that it's benefiting from as a result of my dollars. And that even as a First Amendment issue, and I'm a constitutional conservative, you guys know that. That, to me, may become the bigger issue out of this entire thing. And if we could get people to report on it who weren't being threatened, right? And some reporters do get threatened, as you know, that may be the single best outcome that we could hope to come from this. Not somebody going to jail for a few years, right? Uncovering the influence may be the best thing that comes out of it.
It's amazing how this Democrat and Christine, a Republican, agree so much on these issues. The only thing I want to point out, though, is that when we're talking about APS, and you talk about it as a for-profit, shareholder-oriented entity, which it is, it's really not. It's a unique entity in that they are the utility company that has a monopoly, and I'm an electric bill payer to APS, and a tiny portion of my money they are using to generate their profit that then they use to invest in elections and get corporation commissioners defeated or elected. And so it's really, they're not PetSmart, you know, they're not Intel. They're the monopolistic utility company. And we've got, you always got to keep that in perspective. They're supposed to be regulated by, you know, constitutionally by the Corporation Commission. And it's a whole different world than other private entities.
So when you're looking at APS's power and you're both kind of getting at this, is this kind of related to the dark money initiative that might be on the ballot?
Absolutely.
I saw Bernard Parker this week saying,
Absolutely.
Right, exactly what you said, that they fought against me. In this
APS's
election.
Power, no pun intended. Yeah. Well, yeah, the dark money initiative as a whole, I think they're calling it dirty money now, is a whole other issue. And it seems like that may be headed for a bit of a challenge to get on the ballot. But my sense is, having looked at polling on that, that passes if it gets on the ballot.
Oh, it passes. But the problem is, God bless Terry Goddard, who's leading the charge for it, but he doesn't have a sugar daddy. You know, he doesn't, maybe that's good, but it's really a grassroots effort. And I don't know whether he'll get enough signatures. I think he will, but APS and the Arizona Chamber, they'll go after that. Well, they'll have a flotilla of attorneys moving in to challenge those signatures. Whether Goddard gets enough overage will determine whether the Anti-Dark Money Initiative is successful or not. If it gets on the ballot, it'll pass.
Okay, that's former legislative leader Chris Hurstam. Chris, good luck in semi-retirement, by the
Thank
way.
Thank you.
Although we'll keep hearing your voice here, I'm sure. I hear it in my head all the time. And also former business executive and former congressional candidate Christine Jones. Christine, thank you as
well. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Friday Newscap from KJZZ's The Show. It's an original podcast recapping the week's big stories with experts, commentators, and reporters. You can get the full show podcast at podcast.kjzz.org. If you have any questions or comments, please email us at theshow@kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein, and thanks for listening.